Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and in this episode I'll be speaking to Julius Chitanyi all about paleo art. But before we get into the interview, I'd like to invite you all to enter our first ever competition. Courtesy of Titan Books, we've got three copies of the Paleo Art of Julius Chitanyi, Dinosaurs, Sabretooths and Beyond to give away. So, with an interview on paleo art and a paleo art prize, we just had to run a paleo art competition. What we're looking for is an original piece of paleo art. This can be anything from a simple pencil drawing of a hand specimen to a digitally produced reconstruction of an ancient ecosystem. Just so long as it's paleontology related, we'd love to see what you come up with. So once you've produced an image, all you've got to do to enter is upload it to either Twitter or Facebook using the hashtag PaleoCastArt, all one word, and yes, hashtags do work on Facebook. We'll then pick up the hashtag and put the image out across all our social media. It's here that the judging starts, not by us, not by a panel of professional paleo artists, but by you, our Facebook and Twitter followers. All you've got to do is search for hashtag PaleoCastArt to see all the entries, and then just like the images you like and favourite your favourites. The three images with the most likes and favourites by the end of July the 31st wins. Simple. If you really like an image, you're free to share or retweet it, and we'll still be able to keep track of the total number of likes and favourites. All we ask is that you're not a professional paleo artist. By professional, I guess I mean anyone who makes money off their artwork or has a fancy website, that kind of thing. But if that is you, please, please feel free to show us what you can do. I'd love for this competition to be a celebration of paleo art of all abilities. I just don't want a situation where a pro submits a piece of work off the shelf and gets more likes than a kid who's been drawing all day. But that's where the beauty of this voting system comes in. It's the number of likes and favourites. So even if you're not the best paleo artist, if you put the effort in, draw something from scratch, a rare fossil from the Burgess Shale or an ammonite you found in your backyard, you'll still get the likes. So those are the rules. They're written on our website. Check them out there, along with some of the artwork from Julius's book. And stay tuned for the interview where we're going to talk about all things paleo art and you can get some tips from Julius himself. So best of luck to everyone who enters. And if anyone draws a picture of Willicerops or a Chasmatospidid, I'll buy you the book myself. So with me now is Julius Chitanyi, who's a paleo artist. So Julius, can you tell us how you became a paleo artist?
Well, as far as I can remember, I've always been interested in dinosaurs and prehistoric life. And at the same time, I've always pretty much been doing artwork, beginning just sketching for as far back as I recall. I think my first drawing was something when I was about three or so, according to my parents. And so it's always kind of been there, but it's mostly been a hobby for most of that time. And it was really through initially publishing the work in places like Prehistoric Times by Mike Fredericks and online as well on my website that it became a little bit more viewed. And then in 2005, I was approached to illustrate or partially illustrate an Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs by Dougal Dixon. And from then on, it kind of started to grow a bit. This was during my PhD, so it was a little bit of a tricky balancing act to find the time for it. But it was started out kind of as a side. And gradually, as sort of it kind of spread word of mouth, and I've got contacted by different groups, publishers, and museums, it became a little bit more involved time-wise and slowly grew and then more quickly grew. And then before I knew it, it was pretty much popular enough to become my main career.
So what's your PhD in?
It's in microbiology. I studied extremophilic bacteria, bacteria that live in extreme environments, and specializing in those that transformed heavy metals and metalloids from toxic forms into less toxic forms, and also in phototrophic bacteria, bacteria that can use energy from the light.
Now, we're here talking about dinosaur art, but extremophile bacteria has really got me interested because I'm not a vertebrate fan. I'm sure everyone knows this already. But what kind of environments were these bacteria living in? Was this like in really high temperature places? Oh,
there are some really unusual environments where we can find life on Earth. And I mean, a lot of these environments have been kind of opened up relatively recently. But yeah, there are some really high temperature environments or extremely salty environments, very acidic ones, sometimes more so than stomach acid by a lot. Some of the environments that we studied included, there was a very salty spring system in central western Manitoba that had water anywhere from about twice seawater concentration to saturation, and bacteria lived pretty much throughout the entire range of salinity. We published a paper on that, and it was quite an amazing the diversity of them, and extremely colorful as well because it was an iron-rich spring. The other fascinating and probably in some ways much more exciting location that we studied was the deep ocean hydrothermal vents. Mm-hmm. And for that, I partook in three different research cruises on a research ship that went out to the Juan de Fuca and Explorer ridges in the Pacific Ocean. And we sent down a remote operated submersible to collect samples and observe the hydrothermal vents, these what are called black smoker chimneys, where superheated water that has come in contact with hot rocks below the surface of the land at the bottom of the ocean is spewing out at high rates, and precipitating out from it are these metal sulfides, making it look like smoke, and are surrounding these, just like you see on National Geographic, all these, and a lot on the Discovery Channel and various other shows, you see these communities of both bacteria and animals that are very rich by deep ocean standards. And because of the high energy that's being introduced into the system, you get all sorts of interesting communities happening there. And you get everything from really high temperature water up to 400 degrees Celsius or more, to some of them are more acidic, some are more alkaline, and very rich in heavy metals as well often. And so you get bacteria living in these environments up to over 100 degrees Celsius in some parts of the water. And in the structures surrounding it.
I'd just like to point out that this wasn't scripted and that all just came out the top of your head. That was fantastic.
Okay. It's been fun to talk about it in various times. I recently did a scientific outreach talk for the Royal Tyrolean Museum on some of this material regarding the origin and early evolution of life and how extremophilic bacteria and extreme environments have basically been an important part of sort of molding life on Earth. And so it's always fun to be able to talk about some of this research as well.
So why the dinosaur art and not bacteria art?
that was completely unrelated, beyond the fact that I am interested in most things scientific and the natural world in general. I'm fascinated by how our world is put together and how it operates, and in discovering that. And that's what led me to science. And I am especially interested in the weird and wonderful, the more unusual aspects of life on Earth. And that includes the further back you go, the strange kinds of environments and the animals and plants that we would encounter in the deep past. And so I think that's probably the connection, is the sort of the exploration of unusual aspects of our planet and things that we can't see either because they are too small or too far away or too far back in time.
So you don't think that having a PhD in paleontology is necessary for becoming a paleo artist then?
Well, I think the most important thing is to be able to have the right kind of attitude towards attempting to maintain as much accuracy and rigor in the reconstructions as possible. And for that, it's not necessary to have a paleontology degree to be able to reconstruct these if one has the right attitude toward looking up material in original scientific literature and trying to be careful to maintain accuracy. I've also had the benefit of being able to talk with a lot of paleontologists who are directly working on these subjects, because a lot of the time the artwork comes from commissions to illustrate some of the research that's going on, either to include figures and papers or as supportive material for press releases for the scientific results that come out. So that has also helped me a lot.
So if you imagine I've got a young child to take care of, let's call him John, how would you, and he wanted to be a paleo artist, how would you recommend him doing that?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things that are really useful. And then one of them is lots of practice. So, I mean, that's one thing that you can't really replace with anything. I think art instruction is useful, but practice is absolutely crucial as well. And so that's something to be doing a lot of it, of course. The other thing is it's important to do one's homework and to keep an ear open to the scientific community, because for it to be respected among the paleontologists, which to me is a very, very important part of it, for it to be considered scientific illustration, one has to show that they're willing to, you know, look up this current state of research. And of course, there's going to be some disagreement between different individuals in the science for some of the newer discoveries, for example, before they become well enough corroborated one way or the other. But it's important to try to keep in mind how much evidence there is for something, and to be able to try to be rigorous in reconstructions as much as possible, or at least to state where one, you know, diverges from well-established arguments, where one diverges from well-supported material and becomes a bit more speculative in reconstructions, which is fine, because I mean, we have to make some guesswork as well. Not everything is known, but I think it's important to be able to state what's well-supported and what's not, and then I like to try to keep things as rigorous as possible. And of course, I make mistakes. Everybody does, but we learn. And it's important to keep in mind, to foster an attitude of being open-minded and willing to correct things, and to look out for what's new and important out there, what's new and supported by evidence.
So if you could go back and start over again, would you change anything about the PhD you did, or do a different course or anything like that? Do you think how you've got to being a paleo artist has given you the best of all worlds?
I mean, I think I'm really happy with the route that I took, in the sense that it's given me a diverse background in science, relatively speaking. I started in general ecology and sort of macroecology, studying things like mutualism, and had a chance to look at a bit more sort of harsh environments or extreme environments in my PhD. And so I've had a chance to look more deeply into microbiology as well. And through the paleo art and through more independent study of paleontology, through the papers that are available, I've had a chance to look at this area of research as well. So if I had to change anything, I'd say probably it would be that I would have started with more of a formal background in paleontology academically. That could have helped, makes it a lot easier in some ways to be able to study the material if it's presented by a paleontologist professor, let's say, who is organizing it initially, instead of finding it for oneself. It's easier not to miss things that way, for example. But I'm pretty happy with at least having the ability to get this diverse background. And I guess we can always look and change a few things, but it's hard to say exactly where we all end up that way. But I'd say it would be great to be able to have taken maybe more courses in paleontology initially.
And turning this hobby into a career, are you a full-time paleo artist now?
Yes. So now I'm a full-time paleo artist, I do both paleo art and other types of natural history illustration, including living animals and plants, and pretty much any kind of scientific illustration. However, most of my work these days tends to be paleo art, and it is definitely full time at this point. Yes.
So you've mentioned the encyclopedias as some of the work that you've been doing, but what other clients have you got? You mentioned museums as well.
That's right. And they've been instrumental in my the development of my career, and I'm very grateful for that, for all of these groups. Museums are excellent to work with. In my experience, there have been really neat teams of paleontologists and exhibit designers and curators of exhibits. They were of diverse teams from many different museums. So I've worked a lot with the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology in Drumheller, Alberta, in Canada, as well as the Royal Ontario Museum, also in Canada, the Houston Museum of Natural Science. There's a new museum that's being built right now, the Philip J. Curry Dinosaur Museum in Grand Prairie, and a whole host of other ones, from the Canadian Museum of Nature to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and a variety of them. So there's from all over the place. Most of them have been in North America, but the publishers tend to be from a little bit wider a lot of the time. And I think I've probably worked with more publishers in terms of individual, let's say, stories in magazines or books than with museums. But the larger projects have typically been from museums. I feel strongly about scientific outreach, and I find it very enjoyable to help spread word about how fascinating our world is and what scientists are doing to open it up. Museums are a great way for the public to learn about the natural world and the science that's going on to reveal it. So it's kind of nice to be able to contribute to exhibits that help to sort of facilitate this information spread.
Will it be mostly murals and things that you're producing?
Yeah, most of them are murals. A lot of them are murals. Some of them are life-sized. Those are always fun to produce. Dinosaurs are big in themselves, but to have a life-size mural of dinosaurs and their environment, it makes for some rather large murals. There are also some panels, sort of interpretive panels of various environments and dinosaurs that help to support the exhibits. The murals, though, are, I think, the most fun ones to create.
Are you really limited to what you can produce by the client? Do they say, we want this showing this animal in this kind of environment? Or can you just do what you please, really?
Well, it kind of varies. There's a basic level of what's needed. Certain basic things are needed to be portrayed. And this is usually... this depends on what I'm doing. So, for example, if I'm producing an illustration to support a paper, a scientific paper, then it's going to be important to at least highlight those aspects of the discovery that the paper is reporting on. And so, for example, if most of the material for the paper comes from, let's say, the leg bone of an animal, then it's useful to be able to at least portray the animal in such a way that the characteristics that are described are visible in the image. It helps, of course, to be most pertinent or relevant that way. The clients usually will tell me a basic set of things that they'd like to have illustrated. And then usually they'll kind of leave it to me to display it in a way that I would suggest to be the most aesthetically pleasing, or whatever posture of the animal within the constraints of what we need to show. And I put on my thinking cap and try to figure out some way of portraying it that not only shows what we want to show, but hopefully is as interesting or aesthetically pleasing and maybe attention grabbing as possible, because of course the point of the artwork is to gain the attention of people, to be able to kind of disseminate the information. And same with exhibits in museums, they want to be able to show in many cases highlight not just an individual animal, for example, but how it fit into its environment. And so we have to keep in mind not just the anatomical accuracy of the creatures that we're looking at, but also fill in an accurate background, and also to, you know, to be accurate as much as possible in everything from the geology to the weather, if possible, if we know something about it. Especially the plants is an area that's often missed quite a bit, and so we try to be as true to the science as possible. And so this material is laid out by the client, and then I kind of try to put that together in the most interesting way possible, and then we go back and forth with the client to revise and review the material and tweak it until they're happy with it.
Okay, so let's imagine a client's just come to you and ask for a big picture of a dinosaur. Where would you start in the actual production of that?
Right. So, I mean, I basically first gather the information that's available to me. So that's going to involve talking with the client about what they know. For example, if it's a paleontologist, I'll discuss with them what their research is, you know, what's the gist of the research that's being presented, what they know in general about this, and then read the paper that's being presented, and also any of the material that they have available. And then, of course, it's usually leaves it to me to fill in the background as well. So sometimes we need to show not just the individual animal, but put it into its natural environment. And so sometimes this is not in the specialized field of the researchers who are making the discovery. And I need to go and do a lot of background literature searching and the scientific literature to figure out, you know, how to make an accurate rendition of the background as well. So that's the first part of it. After that, once I've got enough material together and have an idea of what I should be doing, I will do a rough draft of the image, and usually several of them, and we kind of figure out which way we want to display the subject matter. And once everybody's happy with the general direction, so this can take quite a bit of time of going back and forth, talking with sometimes teams of individuals, several different authors, let's say on a paper, or an exhibit design team, for example, and the curators at a museum. And once everybody's happy with the direction, then I can start to fill in some details. And usually this involves doing sort of a mock-up color painting of it to get an idea of what happens next. And from there, of course, I branch in either doing sort of a photorealistic type of photographic compositing type of image, or sort of painted either with traditional or digital media. And then the process kind of changes from then on, either by constructing it from a series of photographs and textures, or painting portions of it a little bit at a time. And then I keep the client in the loop by sending updated works in progress as this develops.
So it sounds like a pretty complicated process and also a digital process. So how have tools like Photoshop and other Illustrator packages helped change the face of paleo art?
Well, I think that for me, the most useful aspect of using digital media is that it is more easily revisable than traditional media. And this to me is very important for doing scientific illustration, both for example, for illustrations that support scientific papers, because in the beginning, of course, when I do the rough draft and also several points during the production of the image, we may have to make changes sometimes because the material is so new that it's maybe not as well known, and it requires a lot of revision potentially as the illustration comes along. And that really helps to be able to have the image on, let's say, different layers digitally rather than having to go and erase physically, let's say, pencil marks, or to create new images. It saves time for me and also allows me to easily be able to transmit information to the various parts of the team. So that's helped a lot. It also introduces some complications because the artwork it's more easy for it to look, how shall I say, it's to make things sort of digitally, it can remove some of that natural artistic look in some cases if it's not done carefully. And this is especially the case with photographic compositing, where not everybody prefers it. And when they do, it's important to be able to be careful enough so that the various parts of it, various components photographically agree with each other in many respects. Otherwise, it becomes really obvious that it's stitched together. And so I try to take care as much as possible when I do photographic compositing to make sure that the various components agree in terms of lighting or amount of blur, the color palette, and so on.
Will you still use a physical medium as well? Like in your day-to-day work, do you, like the murals, for instance, do you just go up and paint them straight on?
Usually, I work with that digitally, exclusively for these larger projects. Again, I think that it helps to speed things along for it creating, or rather, it makes it more revisable, and that's the biggest benefit of it. It can work faster as well, and it requires less of certain materials to be able to construct it, and so it can actually go faster for some portions of it. It also takes more effort for certain other aspects of it, but I pretty much do it exclusively digitally for the larger projects. I do still do the traditional media as well, and for that I basically use it for other kinds of applications. So for example, if it's important that we have originals of artwork, that's where, of course, I will work with traditional media. And a good example of this is in cases where I've done paintings for fundraisers to, say, help with museums that are opening up. And this is something that I'd like to do in the future as well, to, say, promote conservation efforts for fragile ecosystems or endangered animals, for example. I'd like to be able to produce artwork in support of this. Several different artists are doing this. And in these cases, of course, if artwork is, let's say, being used to raise funds, then originals are usually required for this.
So one of the most important issues that you've actually touched on already is, to what extent should paleo art be constrained or represent the paleontological evidence? Now, I've seen one piece of paleo art. I think it was a Tylosaurus that had been swept out of the ocean and dumped into a forest.
Oh, yes.
Have you seen that picture?
Yes. I think so. If I'm thinking of the correct one, this was one by Bob Nichols.
I'm not sure who the artist is.
Okay.
But that, for me, when I saw that, I was like, get out of that tree. Like, what are you doing up there? There's no evidence to suggest that that has ever happened. So should that piece of artwork have been produced? Does it matter that it's not supported by paleontological evidence?
I think that kind of an illustration is fine to produce. And the reason for it is not just, even though there isn't maybe direct evidence for, let's say, a Tylosaurus being in a tree, it is plausible because we do have evidence of Earth being able to produce tidal waves and carrying organisms out into unusual habitats in which they're not normally found. So part of paleo art is creating really, really well-supported, highly rigorous illustrations that are conservative in the science. But part of it is also reminding us that this was a real world, and even if parts of it are missing, we can use other areas of science to be able to fill in the gaps and infer what could have happened, what was more likely to happen. Something's less likely, but we still do see some less likely but plausible things occurring today. So part of scientific illustration and paleo art in particular is to make it interesting images. Some of them are going to be images showing animals and plants and the environment sort of looking like it does on an average day or an average walk if we were to walk into it. And some of it is focusing on interesting and unusual events. But there's nothing in my mind that's implausible about an image of a Tylosaur in a tree next to the ocean if we think of storms being able to produce large waves, or let's say even other serious, a severe weather being strong enough to produce waves that can, you know, hurl an animal out of its natural habitat into one that that is not, you know, it's in which it is normally not found. So it's a combination of being able of using the evidence that's available directly from paleontology and also evidence available from other disciplines to be able to put together a picture that could have occurred at some point.
Do you think there's too much focus on the extraordinary events and the extraordinary animals, for example, say like dinosaurs fighting is a very common thing to have in paleo art. So do you think there's too much focus on the extraordinary and not enough on the ordinary?
So, I mean, you bring up a really good point there. Yes, it's useful to be able to and interesting to show unusual kinds of events, but it's also, it can certainly lead to an undue amount of focus on some of these unusual events, or, you know, as you bring up, kind of typical showing the peak of a fight between animals or a hunt, or what we commonly find is animals hunting other animals, for example. It sort of makes sense that an individual who is going to be producing a piece of artwork wants to, when they're going to put a lot of effort into it, to show something that's going to be sort of impactful or dynamic. At the same time, I think that there is maybe in some cases too much focus on certain kinds of behaviors, and it allows us to sort of focus a bit more now on, or it allows the opportunity to focus on other types of behaviors that are maybe less focused on. So we don't see too many images yet of dinosaurs just kind of hanging out and let's say resting in the sun or just doing things other than hunting each other. And it would be interesting to be able to show more of these. I think this could be useful to produce a bit more of sort of a fine art aspect of paleo art, to show some more of these maybe perhaps less interesting or less dynamic looking behaviors, but probably more realistic, kind of like a Robert Bateman type of approach of showing animals in their habitat, or in other types of wildlife artists that show animals doing things that we would normally see them doing if we were to go out, let's say, on a safari. I think maybe one of the perils of showing these kinds of unusual behaviors is that it's possible to lapse into the not just unlikely or uncommon, but even implausible. And for example, one thing that we see a lot of is predators apparently approaching their prey roaring or otherwise making a lot of noise or whatever. And this is kind of implausible because if you look at predators today hunting, they try to keep as quiet as possible to avoid scaring off their prey in the process. Otherwise, they waste a lot of effort and energy, and it's not ecologically sound. Therefore, I think that more interesting would be to show images of predators sneaking up on their prey. And some artists do this really well. At the same time, we still see quite a lot of artwork showing, and especially true in the case where we can, where there's animation and sound involved as well in motion pictures, seeing predators rushing in, roaring at their prey, which it's less likely.
So in your time as a paleo artist, you've won the Leysendorf Paleo Art Prize twice. Can you tell us about this competition?
Yeah, it's actually provided, it's supported by the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. So yeah, so there, I mean, right away there's, you know, it's vertebrate based. There are other paleo art competitions as well. This is one that I tend to go to the SVP's annual meeting quite a lot. And so this is a crowd with which I'm more familiar than other ones, perhaps. It's a paleo art prize awarded annually to people who enter artwork in the competition. And it has three major categories at the moment. There's two-dimensional artwork, scientific illustration, and three-dimensional artwork. And I in the past, and I'm not sure if it is currently now, there has been animation. And so in these different categories, the artwork is reviewed by a panel consisting partly of scientists. And so different kinds of things are looked for, although I'm not sure of all of what goes into the process. But I consider it to be a pretty nice honor to be able to be recognized this way by the scientific community. And so that to me means a lot.
Have you ever won the PaleoCast art competition before?
No, I have not actually.
I can't do that. That's such a terrible link.
Yeah, no, that one I've not.
No, let's just do it. Let's just go with it.
Sounds good.
Well, we've been kindly given some copies of your new book to give away as prizes. So
very nice.
Can you tell us a little bit about this book that you're releasing?
Right. So it's a compilation of a lot of my artwork from the beginning of my career up to now. And it's very rich in pictures, as you might expect. Right now, it basically focuses pretty heavily, and this is kind of the nice thing about it, on a lot of the new material as well. So I've had a little bit of work shown in the previous book and Steve White's dinosaur art, the world's greatest paleo art. But this material here is a lot of it is also new. And what I find to be a really good aspect of it is that there's a lot of material from museums, exhibits that I've illustrated that the average person probably wouldn't be able to see all of. And so it's a compilation of many things that it would be difficult to be able to view. And it covers everything. So it's organized roughly in a geochronological order, starting with the Paleozoic, then going through the Mesozoic and ending in the Cenozoic. And most of the artwork is Mesozoic in nature, but there is quite a lot of the other ones as well. This way, it's sort of organized in a way that's familiar to people, but at the same time, it allows for the presentation of artwork of different styles in it, because I've been commissioned to do various different kinds of artistic techniques in the past. And so it kind of goes back and forth between line drawings, and many of them appear in places like the Royal Tyrrell Museum, to photorealistic types of photographic compositing in various other museums, such as the Royal Ontario Museum's exhibit, as well as the Houston Museum of Natural Science, Gondwana Studios in Australia, and other ones as well. And things like the sort of acrylic-like digital artwork that is shown in places like the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. And so it's accomplished in many different things that come together. Hopefully it's going to be sort of an interesting presentation of diversity of different kinds of artwork, both in terms of the subject matter paleontologically, as well as the artistic techniques that are involved in it.
What kind of advice would you give to anyone who's going to enter a piece of artwork to this competition?
Well, the important things to keep in mind are that it is judged partly by scientists. And so one needs to be as accurate as possible with respect to the scientific evidence that's available for a particular reconstruction. That's a big part, but also it should be aesthetically pleasing. And so also artists are involved in judging it. So it's something that has to be a nice bridge between science and artwork, which really is what I think the most successful paleo art tends to be. It takes into account not just the evidence, but also tries to present it in the most aesthetically pleasing way. And so the accuracy, as well as the artistic presentation in terms of composition and so on, are all important things to consider, and that have been in the previous successful entries that you see over the years have been very, very important.
Well, Julius, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soul. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
What's your favourite picture that you've ever produced?
Oh, that's a tough one to answer. There have been a variety of different kinds of pictures that have been fun to produce. One of them would be, let's say, some of the largest life-size murals that that I've created for example, the Royal Ontario Museum, the Ultimate Dinosaurs exhibit that opened in 2012. It was neat because we were looking at murals in one case, the size of about 5 meters tall by up to 30 or almost 40 meters long. And so it's basically one image. Of course, stitched together when they print it. But to be able to create the animals at life size and to be able to try to put the amount of detail into it to make it viewable at life size has been a lot of fun. The other ones that have really I've enjoyed are ones that show kind of an unusual perspective. And there's a couple of them actually that show up in the book. One of them that I'd say really stands out to me is a picture that resulted from a discussion with a paleontologist, Dr. Dave Hone. And we were walking through the Royal Tyrrell Museum at one of the preparators conferences and looking at the various reconstructions of skeletons there. We were talking about different kinds of things that could be used in these reconstructions, and in particular in this case about how large sauropods with their massive size would likely have been able to push over trees to feed on them. And so we came up with an image that would try to convey the massive size of these animals pushing over trees to feed on them. And the way in which I'd ended up putting the image together was an unusual perspective from below with a sort of a fisheye lens kind of a view from the ground up. And so we got this massive lumbering, large sauropod above us, an Apatosaurus that has pushed over a tree. And the tricky part and the fun part was to be able to arrange the amount of distortion in the image, because it's a circular image, to make it look as accurate as possible from this standpoint of somebody taking a picture of this sort. And so you can take the image and rotate it around 360 degrees and look at the horizon, and it should work from all different angles, hopefully. But it was a lot of fun to create that piece because it's trying to think in it in sort of a distorted visually way.
So do you have a favorite dinosaur?
That is tricky as well. I think that it's a difficult one for me to answer, because part of why I'm interested in paleontology and science in general is that I really enjoy diversity of the biological diversity of the planet. So I find many different groups to be fascinating simply because they are different from each other. However, if I had to pick a group of dinosaurs, I'd say that I'm more drawn to the theropods in general. I think I like the beauty of the balance of moving on two legs, and the extraordinary amount of balance that requires for them makes their movement, at least in what we see in modern birds, which are of course descendants of dinosaurs, very agile and elegant, and really interesting to look at. I think that among the theropods, there are certain groups that I find to be very interesting and kind of stand out for me. Partly, let's say, for size. So some of the Tyrannosaurs and the Carcharodontosaurs are really, really interesting looking that way. But I think that one of them that really stands out for me as well is the Abelosaurids. The Abelosaurids were a group that had, in the more advanced form, some of the most ridiculously short-looking arms proportional to their thickness, let's say, even more bizarre looking than the arms of Tyrannosaurus, with really, really short humerus, for example, even shorter radius and ulna. And yet, you know, I'm not sure what they used these arms for in some ways. And in addition to that, they've had some very interesting ornamentation on their skin, because of course, in many cases, there's beautiful skin preservation from some of these animals. And some of them are known to have certain large scales interspersed with smaller scales on their backs. And some of them have really interesting cranial ornamentation, everything from ridges on the face to horns in the case of Carnotaurus, for example. Really strange shaped heads as well, like Carnotaurus with its short sort of bulldog-like face in many ways. So they kind of stand out because they're different in certain ways from other theropods. I think they look really interesting in that sense. But like you say, I think most dinosaur groups have really unusual representatives as well. And I find that these kind of bizarre and interesting animals are just fascinating as a whole.
Do you think with theropods that there's too many feathers appearing in paleo art now?
Well, I'm not a paleontologist, so I know that there is a bit of talk one way or another in it, and I think that this is something that we're going to have to wait to see what all of the evidence brings in. But I think that what we're seeing is the growth of a realization of how close these certain groups of dinosaurs were to birds. And we're seeing a lot of, if not direct evidence for feathers in some groups, some phylogenetic bracketing that could be useful to guess where feathers may have appeared, at least in what groups. I know that there's been some work presented in both directions, either in support of more feathers in groups and in support of in reduced support for feathers in some groups as well, and more scales. I think I'll be interested to see where it goes in the long run. But in among the theropods, and especially in some groups of theropods, especially the tyrannosaurs, for example, research, if anything, is showing that that there is a lot more feathers likely have been present in many members than was previously known, at least. So, I mean, we do have impressions of skin of some of them that do show scales. We also have impressions of soft body or soft tissues that show feathers in some groups. And so it's not always easy to determine exactly how much to put and where. I'm trying to figure out based on the available evidence that's being presented. And that is also very dynamic these days, how much to do and where to go with it. I think it's interesting to show, you know, to be able to show both possibilities or the range of possibilities. And so what we're seeing right now is kind of a looking at what's available, but not a complete record yet. And so a lot of gaps still need to be filled. But I think it's nice that people are realizing that there is a strong connection between dinosaurs and birds, and especially certain groups. And like I say, I'm not a paleontologist, and so I think that it'd be much more interesting to talk with somebody who is even more familiar with this in that sense. But from a paleo art standpoint, it's nice to see that some of the scientific discoveries are now being illustrated as well.
So the producer of this book, Titan Publishing, is also a paleo artist, right?
Yeah, the editor, Steve White, is also a paleo artist. And he's done wonderful, very dynamic images of dinosaurs, as well as some extant animals. And I've seen his pictures of sharks, and they're just absolutely jaw-droppingly great.
And who's your favorite paleo artist?
Oh, that one's a tough one. And it's always difficult to answer that because, you know, it's so easy to miss lots of people. It's hard to pick a favorite because there are so many of them that do such wonderful work. So, I mean, if I look back when I began paleo art, there were certain artists that at the time were, you know, there were relatively fewer paleo artists around that were publishing back then. And there were certain individuals that really helped shape my career initially. And among these, some of my favorites have been Douglas Henderson. He's just got some spectacular, very artistic work. very high quality fine art that way. I really loved his work, as well as Mark Howlett, some beautiful murals that he's produced as well that way. And many others, including James Gurney, and some lesser well-known ones from some of the childhood books that I've had, like, for example, Rudolf Zellinger's son, Peter Zellinger, for example, is some really neat stuff as well. There have been some other artists that have not done dinosaurs mostly, but mammals, like Mauricio Anton, who's done some spectacular work that way as well. Gregory Paul with his dinosaurs has been a, you know, big influence on my work initially as well. And many different artists are alive today that are doing some spectacular stuff. So it's really hard to pick a favorite. I know that there have been some that have influenced me more than others, but there's a lot of amazing art out there these days.